Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We're thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. Thanks for joining us, and always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 371 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Doing awesome. I'm glad to be back finally after all these weeks of not being around.
It's been three or four since you were here.
Two.
We missed last week.
And then you had Steven the week before, and I was there the week before.
So that would be 3 weeks.
But I missed two episodes.
But whatever. Okay, fine. Please, what in the world happened? What is Cliv?
Your cursor. You broke up the word there.
I did? It's yep. My fault?
Yep.
Oh, I think when I pressed my record button, it messed it all up. There we go. All right, then. Well, please make sure you like and subscribe and do all those fun things. 5-star rating, thumbs up, and whatnot, so that we can have metrics of success. And then if you're feeling super special, generous, then you could head over to Patreon and, for as little as $1 a month, show support for the show and become part of our community. And you can participate in our politics channel, which is always a hoot. So, what are we doing this episode?
I wish I knew.
Okay, then. Do you want to just vamp and work our way through it?
So, well, we have... Where did my outline go? Did you delete my outline?
Not that I know of. It's still sitting there.
I'm not seeing it. But anyway, we have a case from the North Carolina Court of Appeals. And it's not a fantastic outcome for PFRs. And also, since we're well into the 2026 legislative sessions for most states, and in some cases, it's the end of the legislative session already. But this is a good time to examine some of the great proposals that are pending and working their way through the legislative process. And I have actually two general rules to publish. It was one, but then I added another one because we're way overdue for some good life advice known as Larry's General Rules. And so we got, I mean, don't you think people enjoy these rules about safe living?
I'm sure they enjoy all of them like that. So let's cover this one first. One, you said you found it all over the place, but this one happens to be from Channel 2 in Atlanta, which is WSB. WSB has a pretty long history, doesn't it?
It does. They were the radio side. The TV wasn't invented, but the radio side went on the air on March 15th, 1922.
And that's where Bortz was before he left the air, right?
Yes, that wasn't where he started his career, but that's where he ended his career, was at WSB.
He's pretty entertaining. So this is from Chesterfield County, South Carolina. An inmate told a judge to, quote-unquote, keep the change during a bond hearing and was returned to jail on additional charges. According to a statement issued by the Chesterfield County Sheriff, 33-year-old Patrick Alexander of Mississippi is facing additional charges after authorities say he attempted to use counterfeit money while posting bond. So, since I can't see what is possibly wrong with this, what's your general rule?
Well, I would start by encouraging everyone not to pass counterfeit money because it's both state and federally prosecutable. But if you feel you must use counterfeit money, against my advice, don't try to post bond with a court using counterfeit money. They might just know how to detect it.
I mean, all you need is, can't you just buy that pen at like Office Depot?
That's what is still in use a lot of places today, that counterfeit detection pen. Yes, you can.
So Alexander was charged with forgery following the incident on March 16th, according to officials.
And the funny thing is that the judge had set Alexander's bond on the charge it was pending, which was trespassing, at only $250. But I've been confused since I've seen this story because it says after receiving his personal property, Alexander allegedly pulled out a wad of cash, sorted through it, and handed it to the judge and threw three $100 bills, telling the judge to, quote, keep the change. I've been in jail from coast to coast, and I have never figured out how you would be able to pull money out of your clothing when you're in a bond arraignment. That's I'm still confused.
Is it possible that he, you know, so whenever they took him into custody, they inventory your property, whatever the right terms are. You hand him your wallet and you take off your watch and your wedding ring, whatever all those things are. So wouldn't they write down on a little post-it and a little receipt, whatever, that there was $300 cash in the guy's wallet?
Well, they would. They would give you a receipt for your property, but you're now in a jumpsuit. You're facing a judge and they're setting bond. How does he pull three $100 bills out of his property that he no longer has possession of?
Well, so I'm just theorizing here is that since they knew that he had the cash, he's like, judge, I have it in my property. And so maybe the bailiff, whichever position would have been, they brought him his stuff and he pulled that out. Maybe.
Well, only if the judge was at the jail. But if you're 30 miles away at the courthouse, how would you do that?
I guess my experience is that the jail is connected through a tunnel underneath, like where the good people walk around.
In some cases, yes. Here in Bernalillo County, it's way over. I mean, they do have courtrooms in the jail. They have courtrooms in the detention facility over there. But you still would not be able to get your property at what we call Metropolitan Detention Center. You're in an isolated courtroom that's designed specifically for detention hearings, and you wouldn't have access to your property. Now, perhaps an officer could go get it. But anyway, that confused me.
And so but the judge said, no, I'm going to decline to keep the change.
And the funny thing is that's additional evidence that he knew his money was counterfeit, because most of the people are not excited about giving an extra $50 to get out of jail.
Right. Well, then onward to another one. Prosecutors allege that drug transactions were found on Alabama basketball star Aiden Holloway's phone after he was arrested Monday on a felony drug charge, according to documents obtained by ESPN. But Holloway's attorney says police violated Holloway's constitutional rights when they searched his home.
Well, again, if you're dealing drugs, I don't encourage you to do that.
So don't pass counterfeit money and don't deal drugs. What are we supposed to do in our free time?
I don't know, but I strongly urge that you not conduct this type of business on your cell phone. That would be one of my general rules would be if you're running a drug operation, don't use your cell phone.
I have thoughts on that subject. So an officer with the West Alabama Narcotics Task Force, according to the documents, found drug transactions on Holloway's phone after seizing $400 that was located in a jacket. Holloway told the officer he uses marijuana for personal use and that he obtained the marijuana from outside state. The money is being seized due to seeing drug transactions on Holloway's phone, with people texting what they were going to get up with him, that they were going to get up with him after the season. Prosecutors said in a complaint filed Friday, Holloway had smaller denominations in his possession, which is indicative of narcotics sales. Larry, I know you carry a lot of cash around, but do you carry it in large bills or small bills?
Well, I do both. I'm typically carrying some $100, which is the largest in circulation, and I have it broken down because nobody will take $100 anymore because they know it's counterfeit. So you end up.
Holloway
end up not...
had smaller denominations. So if you carry fives and twenties, you're dealing drugs?
Well, it depends on how many fives and twenties.
I see. Okay. So Holloway had smaller denominations in his possession, which is indicative of narcotic sales. The marijuana was in a separate packing, from plastic bags to prepackaged marijuana to vacuum sealed bags.
Police searched Holloway's apartment after officers conducted a trash pull and found marijuana and marijuana paraphernalia attached to containers with Holloway's name on them in a pair of trash bags they grabbed from his garbage bin, which no warrant is needed, according to the search warrant. At least in general, generally, there's no your trash is abandoned. The search warrant says police pulled Holloway's trash after there had been complaints. The documents, according to the documents obtained by ESPN, they do not specify what the complaints were about. So, folks, if you're going to deal drugs, try not to be doing things that would cause your friends or neighbors or people to complain about you. You got to keep it kind of low key, really low key.
You would think. Holloway posted $5,000 bail that he pulled out of his wallet. I'm just kidding. It doesn't say that. He pulled $5,000 bail and was released from the Tuscaloosa County Jail shortly after his arrest. He has been charged with a Class C felony drug possession charge. not for personal use, and a failure to affix a tax stamp charge. Was he supposed to collect sales tax when he sold the dope?
Well, apparently so, even though I think it's illegal in Alabama.
They are both felonies and both carry a maximum sentences up to 10 years in jail and a $15,000 fine. Now, what I got under, I don't understand, Larry, is it is really easy to do everything very, very encrypted these days. I don't understand, like, you can use an app called Signal. Don't you remember, like, a year ago, the Signal gate with the Trump administration?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so they're using, like, the most encrypted messaging app that there is, but some doofus was using a variation of it, and that was sending messages elsewhere. But the app itself and the program itself is very secure, and you could say, only store messages for, like, 5 minutes, let's just say. And they're gone! Like, I can't understand how this is that hard. I need my dope, and in 5 minutes, the message is gone. What are they going to have? They're not going to have anything. I don't get it.
So, well, that's beyond my knowledge level. But the sad thing for this young man is he's probably not from Alabama. He's attending the university. And if he was from one of these states that's a little more lenient with criminality, he would have no idea what was coming at him. 10 years sure. on each one. If they stack these, they probably won't, because he should have the resources to put up a robust defense. And Tuscaloosa County is about as liberal as it gets in Alabama, which isn't saying much.
But, I mean, yeah, but, right?
but he's possibly ruined his life. Not ruined it, because he's got enough athleticism. He can probably play ball in the NBA without any real hardship, because this won't put him on the PFR registry. But he's got a lifetime scar for being stupid and irresponsible, and that's really sad. And so you just gave your encryption advice, right?
I did.
How do you do that? So I'm sitting here with my phone, and I want to say I want to run a drug deal after we get off the air. How do I encrypt that so that I won't get caught?
Well, I know that you used, I know that you use Telegram, and Telegram is encrypted, but it's a private algorithm, and I've heard it's pretty much trash. But by default, Larry, the encryption isn't turned on. Now, I don't know if you and whoever you use it with turns the encryption on, but it's not on by default. So the answer is use the app called Signal. And then my phone number will pop up, and we can message that way. It's just like text messaging, and it's completely encrypted, and you can make phone calls with it as well.
So could I resort to mobile behavior, making calls that people didn't particularly want?
I mean, you probably could, but like the whole point is you actually know who's the person on the other end. Like there's this whole system inside of it that you have identity verification going on. There's this long, long, long string that I know that if I got a message from you, I would know that it's authenticated. So no, this would not be this is not an anonymous app. I think that's what you're asking.
I see. So I wouldn't be able to get back into my business, but I had to get out of that business because nobody answers their phones anymore. You can't call anybody.
I think that's probably a good thing too. All I get is scam calls, Larry. It says scam likely, phone numbers I don't recognize. And it says, hey, your loan has been approved. I'm like, I didn't do. Just stop calling. Just stop.
So, all righty then.
All right, well then, where did this come from? This is the Magnolia Tribune is where this article comes from. The Mississippi Senate bill would allow the death penalty for sexual battery. Mississippi legislators are considering a bill to make serious sexual battery against children punishable by none other than death. The bill would apply to offenders over 18 who sexually batter a child under 12, causing organ injury. Now, what do you make of this? This doesn't really sound too far-fetched, but it doesn't sound great either.
Well, it's similar to what happened for the decades after Roe versus Wade was decided. The conservatives, and the liberals do the same thing if it's something they don't agree with, but the conservatives in this case are angry since the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2008 deems the death penalty unconstitutional for non-homicide crimes, with exceptions for crimes against the state, certain crimes against the state. The bill even acknowledges its unconstitutionality, but aims to challenge the existing Supreme Court precedent.
Now, if legislators in the House and Senate can nail down a compromise, convictions of serious sexual battery against children will be punishable by death in Mississippi. Senator Jeremy Englin, Republican of Van Cleve, first proposed the bill early in the legislative session. His argument when he presented the bill first to a Senate committee, then on the floor, was that violent sexual battery, especially of a child, was depraved enough to merit the death penalty.
Yes. I don't know about these people down there. I'm going to have to add them and Alabama together. The bill would allow prosecutors to pursue the death penalty for people over 18 who are convicted of sexual battery, as you stated. The case is only eligible for the death penalty if the perpetrator injures the organs, which we covered that according to the specific language in the bill, and if a 12-person jury unanimously determines that at least two aggravating factors apply.
Now, did I hear you correctly?
They know it's unconstitutional.
So they know it's unconstitutional, yet they're doing it anyway.
Yes, you heard me correctly. You did. And that's so much for putting their hand on the Bible and taking their oath of office. Now, they all do that. Now, some states, you don't put it on the Bible. You just raise your hand and take the oath under the penalty of perjury.
I assure you they put it on the Bible there, though.
They probably do. But they all swear and they tell in their public gatherings how much they believe in the Constitution and how they would defend it. Well, but at the same time, they're saying, hey, we're going to violate it. We know it's a violation. And this is since 2008. So it's not a new precedent. The U.S. Supreme Court has maintained that a death penalty can only be administered if homicides or crimes against the state, such as treasons. England's bill even concedes that the policy is currently unconstitutional and allows that if the state or federal Supreme Court hears a Mississippi appeal and reaffirms its unconstitutionality, which they probably won't, but if they do, he says that the death sentence will become a life sentence in prison. He and others believe as more right-wing justices have been placed on the court, and it has shifted to the right in recent years, though some members have signaled their willingness to hear the similar cases, and he believes they'll likely result in an opposite result than what happened in 2008. Please admit that that's funny.
So what method of execution does Mississippi use?
It looks like, from my research, execution by firing squad, because they can't get the drugs that they need. So if Mississippians are listening, I've got that wrong, let us correct it next week. But I think they do it by firing squad.
And if I'm not mistaken about that, Larry, that is because the places around the world that make the drugs have determined that it is inhumane. They don't want to be a part of that practice, so they are no longer making that drug available in the United States to be used for that purpose.
That is the way I understand it. And I guess the stockpiles went out of date because we don't execute people fast enough, so they had to trash the existing inventory.
Now, if we were to accelerate that rate and we were to evict all the people that we don't want, wouldn't we have like a population of, like, I don't know, 50 million people?
I don't know if I follow that question.
But we're trying to get rid of so many so fast. We only want the Scandinavian countries to come here. Sorry, it's a little tongue-in-cheek. So the story explains that the Supreme Court previously ruled in a 5-4 vote that a Louisiana man could not be sentenced to death for the rape of his 8-year-old stepdaughter because she didn't die. And her death wasn't, I'm sorry, she didn't die and her death wasn't intended.
Yeah, that death was not intended. And I guess, but perhaps maybe if you intend to kill somebody.
I got you. I'm sorry. I understand that. Since she didn't die and he didn't intend to die her.
And they stated that handing down a death sentence in his or other cases would violate evolving standards of decency and the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. That evolving standard of decency is nothing but a bunch of liberal mumbo-jumbo nonsense. Don't you agree?
I think so. I believe that would be mumbo, not mambo.
Mumbo-jumbo. So now what's interesting to me, and I've been harping on this the last few episodes, these are the people who promise you with all their heart that they're trying to keep the cost of government down, and they're watching every penny. It is a given fact that imposing the death penalty is one of the most expensive penalties that we can ever impose. It exceeds the cost of life imprisonment because of the perpetual appeals. Now, their answer, of course, is to get rid of the appellate process and just let them be juiced right away. But it costs a lot of money to execute a person. And yet the people that are guarding your purse are proposing to spend your money, and you don't have any problem with it. Do you see any problem with your logic?
So just for clarity, it's not that the act of nuking someone is expensive, but they get three appeals or whatever, and those costs are provided, if I'm not mistaken?
Is that right? Yes, in most states, the death penalty is automatically guaranteed a pathway to the Supreme Court of that state. And then you've got federal courts to go into afterwards if you want to go that route, and most people do, because very few people really want to die. So you've got the route to the state Supreme Court guaranteed, and they have to provide representation for that. These cases are extremely complicated. So you can spend more money putting someone to death. And when you ask the conservative this question, they do like they do with everything else. They pretend like they don't hear you, and they flip to another subject, and they come up with some mumbo-jumbo rather than answering the question. And if you finally get an answer out of them, what they will say is that some things you just need to not let money matter. You just need to do the right thing. That's what you can force them to say. But they won't talk about the money that it costs to execute someone. They don't do that.
I got nothing else.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
So you put this case in here from North Carolina's Court of Appeals, and it is an appeal by a person who challenged having to provide
the internet monikers.
I see. Okay. And that would be name, like your email address and a username or whatever?
All the stuff related to the use of the internet.
Okay. And so the case is the state of North Carolina versus Richard Smathers. Now, what is this about? You just said it was about internet identifiers.
Yeah, it's an appeal by defendant named Smathers from a judgment entered on the 4th of April, 2024 by Judge Karen E. D. Williams in Buncombe County Superior Court.
Now, what was that county again? How do you pronounce that?
Buncombe.
Buncombe, huh? And if we were to say that really quick with kind of like some slurred language, we could come up with some interesting ways to say that.
I believe it's Buncombe. I've been through there, and I think I've heard it pronounced that way. But again, North Carolinians, we got thousands of them, so they can tell us. But I think it's Buncombe.
So let me set up the case. And this is Richard N. Smathers appealed from judgment of guilty after a jury trial where he was convicted of failure to report an online identifier with the registering sheriff. And for being a habitual felon. Habitual felon. Now, that does not sound good, honestly.
No, it does not. And here in the beautiful land of enchantment, it's not possible to utilize a habitual felon law for failure to comply with PFR registration. Because remember, folks, if you'll get off of your reluctance, it's a civil regulatory scheme. So therefore, you haven't committed a criminal act in the line of what they were thinking about when they designed the habitual a felon act. So we have exempted it specifically from the habitual felon, the habitual enhancement law. You cannot be enhanced for a lifetime or 30 or 40 or 50 years for violating a civil regulatory scheme.
Now, Smathers asked the court to reverse his conviction because the statutory reporting requirement is facially unconstitutional. How did that go?
Not very well at all.
Now, I've read the case while I was climbing on a ladder hanging a security camera, and I can see that Smathers was not a particularly appealing person to assert this challenge. In 2010, a jury in Buncombe County Superior Court convicted Smathers of taking indecent liberties with a child. On 21st of December 2022, as he began post-release supervision after an unrelated imprisonment, Smathers visited the Buncombe County Sheriff's Department to register as required. The office gave him a duty to register packet listing the registration and reporting requirements. What were those requirements?
Well, I just focused on the online identifiers, and it says, I am required to provide and verify the use of any online identifiers with the registering sheriff's office. Online identifier is defined. It means electronic mail address, instant message screen name, user ID, chat or other internet communications name, but it does not mean social security number, date of birth, or PIN number, and that's in North Carolina General Statutes 14-28.6, subsection 1N. And it says, I understand that if I change an online identifier or obtain a new online identifier, then I must report in person within 10 days to the registering sheriff to provide the new or changed online identifier information.
Now, I'm guessing that he signed that bullet, whatever, that line item?
He did. Smathers marked each paragraph, including the above language, with his initials. He also signed two forms acknowledging receipt of the packet. Then he had an opportunity to ask questions about it, and he understood its contents. On that date, Smathers reported only two online identifiers, a Gmail address and a Grindr account. What is a Grindr account? Does that mean you're grinding or what?
That's what it's for. Like hip grinding. Mm-hmm. How did they discover that he had unreported internet identifiers?
Well, it was not that hard. On June 16th, 2023, Smathers had a scheduled appointment with Officer Amy Cleary, who was a probation and parole officer with the Department of Adult Corrections. The conditions of his post-release supervision, including warrantless searches of his electronic devices. We're kind of having that internal discussion around the organization. You might be familiar with it.
I am, yes.
While searching his phone, Officer Cleary saw two social media applications with reportable online identifiers, Grindr and Snapchat. In the Snapchat app, she saw an account with the username Nathan_Smathers created on 8 January 2023. She photographed the account information on his phone. When she asked if he had reported the account, Smathers said he intended to do so that day.
Then did Smathers make any incriminating statements during that encounter?
He did. Smathers admitted that he was using Snapchat to send pictures of his junk. Now, you have to admit that that is funny.
The last section almost had me in tears. So yes, this all is funny, but in reality, no, it's really not that funny. It's not funny to a normal person. It's probably funny to you. Smathers was arrested and charged for failing to report his online identifiers with being a habitual felon. When the case came to trial, he moved to dismiss the substantive charge on First Amendment grounds. Now, how did that part go?
Well, the trial court denied this motion. And then defense counsel again renewed the motion to dismiss on the same grounds at the close of the state's evidence and the close of all evidence, and the court again denied the motions. The jury then convicted Smathers. Imagine that.
Yeah, weird. So now we are at the appeal stage. What did Smathers argue on appeal?
On appeal, Smathers argued the reporting requirements of North Carolina General Statutes, blah, 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 are facially unconstitutional under the First Amendment.
So the First Amendment provides that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Now, what is the burden that a challenger must overcome?
Generally, but not always, and we'll get into more as we go through the remainder of this, but litigants mounting a constitutional, a facial or unconstitutional challenge to a statute must establish that no set of circumstances exist where the statute would be valid. And they cite United States versus Salerno, which is a 1987 decision that I'm quite familiar with because it has to do with the Bail Reform Act put into place by the Reagan administration. And it makes it where that you're more likely to be held facing federal charges and pretrial detention. And that was litigated as a denial of your right to bail. And lo and behold, the Supreme Court said, no, it's not a violation because of a number of reasons it'll take up too much time. But they decided that it was not unconstitutional, so they can hold you pretrial now. And have been since 1987.
Okay. And so then would it have been better if he'd asserted an as-applied challenge?
No, it wouldn't have been better. I don't think. You're correct. It was Smathers did not claim the statute was unconstitutional as applied to the facts of his own case, and the court noted he need not do so to establish standing, because he needs standing in the case. They pointed out that litigants to whom a statute is lawfully applied to have standing to argue the statute violates the First Amendment on its face because it's overbroad. And they cited United States versus Hansen, and that's a more recent 2023 case. And also, his facts are not that good for an applied challenge. Actually, his facts are not good for any type of challenge, but...
Now, and as applied, just real quick, is a cousin, a sibling, whatever, to facially unconstitutional?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you're narrowing the challenge down to just your circumstances rather than you just can't do that. When you're saying facial, you're saying you people can't do this, period. It's against the Constitution.
I gotcha.
When you do as applied, you're saying you can't do this to me because of X, and you cite the reasons why applying it to you would make it unconstitutional.
All right. And it's well established that the Constitution gives significant protection from overbroad laws that chill speech within the First Amendment's vast and privileged sphere. That's from Ashcroft versus Free Speech Coalition, 535 U.S. 234 and 244 from 2002.
That is correct. Man, you did some good research.
Okay.
That is a good case to cite. The court stated it must be noted that we seldom uphold facial challenges because it is the role of the legislature. Gee, that sounds familiar with the conversation we've had this past week. Rather than this court to balance desperate interests and find a workable compromise among them. You elect people to make the laws, folks. The courts just guard the Constitution. If you don't like the laws they're making, quit electing the people that are making the laws you don't like.
That sounds so weird. The court stated then, as threshold matters, we must determine whether the challenged statutory scheme implicates First Amendment activity and which level of scrutiny to apply, which depends upon whether the statutes are content neutral. What level of scrutiny did they decide is proper in this case?
They decided it intermediate scrutiny. They just did that because the reporting requirement makes no reference to the content of the online identifiers, merely the type and format, such as email addresses. You know, you have to provide the tools, but you can speak all you want to on these platforms. So they do not prohibit the communication of any specified ideas or any subject matter. Therefore, the court determined that intermediate scrutiny is appropriate standard which to judge this law's constitutionality.
I have to divert for a moment and ask you this question, because if you know someone is watching you, won't that change what you may or may not say? Therefore, that is violating your First Amendment right?
Well, yes, that's the argument he's making, but that's the overbreadth part of it and the chilling aspect of it. But content-wise, the government is not telling you that you must speak a certain message, or they're not telling you you cannot speak a certain message. So there's no restrictions on the content. It does have a potential chilling effect if you know the popo is watching you.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. I know if you know that your popo is potentially looking at your junk pictures, you might be, for all the better reasons that this is true, maybe you wouldn't send those pictures of your junk.
Well, you or not be sending your junk on anybody. No way.
Nobody wants to receive them, is from what I understand it to be true. But that's not the point. If you want to send it, you should be free to send it.
No, well, that's against the Bible.
All right. Well, then, so what makes these things content neutral?
Well, laws which impose burdens on speech without reference to the ideas or the views expressed in most instances are considered content neutral. On the other hand, a content-based regulation is presumptively unconstitutional, and it can only survive if it satisfies strict scrutiny. Like if they tell you you must put up a sign that says that you've got bubonic plague, then they that's forcing you to speak, and you have to, when you do that, it's assumed unconstitutional unless they can show that it's absolutely necessary for public safety. And then there was a time in this country where we forced people to post signs when they were being quarantined, and there was nothing wrong with that from a constitutional perspective because they had a contagious disease.
And it would be something factual, but somebody that has a sexual conviction is not going to spontaneously offend every person that walks down the street.
No, but we can't take any chances around here.
I see. All right. Well, then the court stated statutes regulating conduct while incidentally burdening speech are valid, provided that they are justified without reference to the content of the regulated speech, that they are narrowly tailored to serve a significant governmental interest, and that they leave open ample alternative channels for communication of the information. So we need to have a dedicated channel, Larry, that we can send pictures of our junk. We need a dedicated channel. Right.
But more to the point, PFRs are not prohibited from using the internet or communicating by this law. It's like people that say that they can't travel internationally. You can travel all you want to. You just may not get in.
Yes. Now, I noticed then on page 10, the court stated, it is evident beyond the need for elaboration that a state's interest in safeguarding the physical and psychological well-being of a minor is compelling. They went on to say, recidivism presents tremendous challenges unique to sex crimes. When convicted PFRs reenter society, they are much more likely than any other type of offender to be rearrested for a new rape or sexual assault. I call bullshit on that one.
I do too, but they cited McCune versus Lyle, and that's a 2002 case from U.S. Supreme Court. And they also stated statutory strategies which prevent a PFR from engaging in conduct that often presages a sexual crime, like contacting a minor or using a website to gather information about a minor, must be in the state's first resort to ward off the serious harm that sexual crimes inflict. And they cited Packingham, which everybody's familiar with, listen to this podcast. That's a U.S. Supreme Court decision more recently.
Yes. And Smathers offered three reasons why the statutory scheme is overbroad. First, he argued that the statutes are categorical and indiscriminately sweep up too much online activity, obliging offenders to report all their online identifiers, including those associated with internet platforms that can't reasonably be used to commit crimes, sex crimes, and apply to broad swaths of lawful speech. Second, they provide no exception for offenders who have never engaged in the sort of online activity that the government seeks to deter and thereby impermissibly fail to account for individualized risk. Third, he argues that there is no meaningful limitation on law enforcement agencies' use of an offender's online identifiers or any constraining principle on their public release which deemed necessary for their protection or upon written request. Now, what did the court say in response to those three claims?
Well, they were so unpersuaded that they didn't even bother to address them individually. They said, quote, none of these reasons is sufficient to show that the statute is overbroad on its face. Also, they said the fact that a statute might operate unconstitutionally under some conceivable set of circumstances is insufficient to render it wholly invalid. Now, they're right about that. That's why you do the as-applied challenge rather than the facial. Because then you start theorizing, well, it might be invalid under these hypothetical circumstances. Well, then you need to put forth an as-applied challenge.
So do you think, though, that even having these reporting requirements would deter some speech, even if it does not forbid it?
It probably would. I think that anybody who knows that the Pope has got all their identifiers. Now, it doesn't say you have to give them any passwords or anything, but how much can you get by just having to knowing that they're on these platforms? What, you're the tech guru, what can you find out about a person when you know that they're on Snapchat without their password?
Wouldn't they have to follow you back so that you know, hey, you get a friend request from Popo Smith and you're going to say yes, and then they're somehow going to know what messages you send to other people? I could see them following you on Facebook and then anything that you post there or on Twitter or anything like that, that they would have whatever you post publicly. So, like, I'm struggling to figure out, other than one other aspect of that, is that the Facebooks then have access to your email address, and then they know that you're a PFR, and then they just boot your account. So that they just shut down the avenue for you to have that place as an avenue to communicate with people.
Well, what I would say in response is maybe they would do that, but if you see some, let's say you're into men and you see some gorgeous hunk that you don't know that sends your friend request, you might all be dubious. It might be a police officer that's putting up his 20-year-old college photo.
It could also be a hot police chick.
But as the state argued, the reporting requirements do not categorically prohibit PFRs from speaking on the internet. And they said this distinguishes the statute from the law in the United States Supreme Court struck down in Packingham. to which North Carolina had made it a felony for PFRs to use any commercial social networking website where he knows a minor children are permitted to create accounts. There, the Supreme Court held that the state may not enact this complete bar to offenders exercise the First Amendment rights on websites integral to the fabric in modern society and culture. And that was on Packingham 582 U.S. at page 109. They said in the instant case, however, offenders retain the right to use the internet to engage in public discourse so long as they have reported the identifier used or timely report a new one within 10 days. So I just don't see that. See, when something's struck down, you go back and you make a law and you see how close you can get. And this is what North Carolina did. And the wrong person challenged it. This guy was not very sympathetic if I'd put all this crap in here. But I don't know that it would have been any different if the right person had challenged it, because they're in state court and that state court system is not particularly receptive, apparently.
And you're saying that this is then in response to Packingham?
If it's a new law, I would say that this was a newly crafted law to try to at least keep tabs on PFRs, because, you know, they tried to exclude them all together when they passed the law that was struck down in Packingham. And these people don't go away. They don't say, well, we lost, we give up. They keep going back, just like they did for 50 years to overturn Roe v. Wade. They don't give up.
So as we wrap this up, can you provide I'm gonna change this, Larry. Can you provide a quack summary?
A quack summary? Well, I could. I think it's summed up very well. The court stated, in furthering law enforcement's information gathering for sex crime prevention, the requirements as to online identifiers cover neither too much activity nor too many offenders, and the associated public disclosure provisions impose significant limits on release of that information. The statutes impose no speech restrictions, preferring instead to deter recidivist online conduct by mandating regular disclosures.
But they also said this may incidentally burden some speech activity, but this possible encroachment is insufficient to override other relevant public interests, and it does not establish that the legislature failed to narrowly tailor its requirements. It is not our role to determine whether this was the best regulatory method to confront this challenge, and the First Amendment does not require the legislature to choose the least restrictive method available. In these analyses, where the legislature has balanced competing interests and struck a workable compromise, we show their solution ample deference.
And I wish the listeners were really cue in if they don't listen to anything else on this episode. What would you just read there? Because when people are against a law, they'll cite five different ways that they can come up. It could have been done better. But there's nothing that requires a law to be effective. They'll say, well, the data shows this doesn't work. It's not required that the data show that a law work. That's a prerogative that you, the voter, have to require that people you elect to represent you only enact laws that work. But from a constitutional perspective, matter of fact, you ought to read that again to make sure people understand this part here. It says, but it's insufficient to override the relevant public interest, and it does not establish that the legislature failed to narrowly tailor. And then, emphasis, it's not our role to determine whether this was the best regulatory method to confront this challenge, and the First Amendment does not require the legislature to choose the least restrictive method available. Translated, it doesn't require them to choose the best way in your opinion. Your opinion is your vote. If you don't like the choices they've made, vote for someone different.
And on top of that, though, you could go be involved in the legislative process where they were like working this out, that you could have helped tailor, maneuver, manipulate, change, whatever, the law. You may have liked your candidate, but maybe your candidate isn't qualified, but you could have still helped craft and structure and whatever this law.
Indeed. And most people don't have the time or take the time. And this hits them. They say, huh, nobody told me about it. I never knew anybody. Well, the legislature's open. It's all on the website. It's all available to the public. It's much easier now to be involved than it was when I started being involved almost 170 years ago.
Now, you know, Larry, it's all kabuki, and they do stuff back channel and closed doors, and they call sessions at 2 a.m., and there's no chance that any normal person could ever figure this out and be involved in it.
Well, some of that is true. They do have things at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they do sometimes schedule things when they know that people are not going to show up. That is a true statement. But guess what? You have to show up anyway.
I understand. Do you want to go over anything else before we leave?
No, I'm satisfied, and we're looking forward to your analysis on the New Mexico verdict against Meta. We'll do that next week if you're ready.
I will be ready. I think it was also against YouTube, but I'm not positive. But I think so. Well, cool. Well, head over to registrymatters.co for show notes, and then you could send email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can leave an old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And please support us on Patreon for, as I said before, as little as a buck a month. It shows the support. We love it. And you can do that at patreon.com/registrymatters. And also, if you want to go buy some swag, head over to fypeducation.org/shop. You can find t-shirts and mugs and mouse pads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all I got.
I think we've already sold $26,000 worth of merchandise.
We have sold a nice amount, and it would be nice to sell some more. Because there's one, says, what is it, not a civil regulatory scheme? Or registration, whatever. Anyway, there's one that says something about a civil regulatory scheme, which is pretty fabulous. And so I hope you guys have a great weekend. Larry, have a great rest of your weekend, and I will talk to you very soon. Have a good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.